Holmes & Hops is proudly supported by Platt Insurance, your local independent insurance agency offering auto, home, life, business, and farm insurance. They also have a team of specialists that help you with insuring your brewery or winery. Platt Insurance, helping you protect your tomorrow. For more information or a quote, please call them at 330-856-6244 or visit them on the web at plattinsurance.com. Hey everyone, Lisa Resnick at the Homes and Hops podcast studio with Phil Kidd back in town from Cleveland, which you often do come back, which is awesome.
Yes.
I love seeing all your posts. So Phil, definitely, he's a runner. He's an advocate of the community. And he's also a foodie, which is phenomenal. Is that the balance, the whole like food, running, so then you can enjoy them both?
Definitely factors in. There's no doubt about that. Yeah, I do like to enjoy and indulge.
Yeah, because it's not like, it's like one of those foods that you could truly like, you're like, oh, wow, that's something that you're going to definitely bite into and enjoy.
For sure.
But it's one of those things that you will enjoy without worry a lot more if you run before you eat it.
Yes. That's a good point. Absolutely right. That's right.
So you also brought some Cleveland beers with you.
I did. I brought a sampling of four different beers from three different breweries. Two are IPAs. One is a Pilsner and another one is a Stout. And the breweries are Platform Brewery, which is on the west side. It's kind of near where I live. It's a pretty popular brewery. It's now kind of, their distribution is pretty extensive. But the thing about Platform is that they're highly experimental. So they are constantly, every time you go to Platform Brewery, you're going to see a half a dozen to a dozen new beers every time you go.
Is Platform the one that's like located a little bit off the ways from the more central downtown area?
Yes, it's technically considered the Ohio City neighborhood.
Yes, that's the one.
That's it, yeah. It's on a street called Lorraine Avenue, which is kind of a commercial district that's on a rebound, you know?
Okay.
And so they were a very important business in that sense in regards to helping revitalize that district. They were one of the first ones to kind of anchor in. And a very popular brewery in Cleveland. But what kind of their claim to fame is just highly experimental, high quality. Everything they make is very interesting, or very high quality, but just interesting different blends. And then the next two is from a brewery called Goldhorn, which is a brewery on the east side of Cleveland on East 55th Street. It's a Slovenian themed brewery, and Goldhorn in Slovenia, there's a mythic, like the gold-horned like ram is like a mythical figure of lore in Slovenia. And so you'll see when you walk in there, this huge bust of like the gold horn ram. And this is their two most popular beers. One is the Polka City Pilsner and also the Dead Man's Curve IPA, which is named after a bend of highway in downtown Cleveland, which makes like a 90-degree angle before you hit Lake Erie. And so people call it Dead Man's Curve, you know, naturally. And then the last one is from Masthead Brewery. It's one of my favorite breweries. It's in downtown Cleveland on East 12th Street. Just really high quality. The person who was our marketing director at the organization I work at, she ended up becoming the marketing director there. Her boyfriend is the owner of the place.
And, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, really great. And so they're big supporters, too, of like community development, neighbor development. They often donate a lot of beer to events, you know, for different fundraisers and things like that that are happening in Cleveland. But these are a few of the breweries I really like. There's probably, I don't know, another half dozen breweries in Cleveland. But this is a good sampling. This gives you a good sense of things.
You definitely picked out a variety. And I know you all can't see this, but it's a nice, you see the variety of color in the beers, which is pretty neat. And the first one, Platform, you said it was the most hopped flavored one?
I think so. It's a hazy IPA. So typically the flavor, like the flavor palette there is probably the most pronounced, you know, but I'm a particular fan of hazy IPAs, and this is one that I really like. So I think it's good.
I do. At first, I mean, when I was younger, I don't think I liked the taste of hops at all.
Yeah.
But now I really do. Right. I really enjoy the taste of good hops. So let's
Yeah, we'll cheers start there. To. Cheers. Absolutely.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah, it's great to be back. This is round two for me here.
I know.
Yeah, I really enjoyed our first conversation. This is really cool.
A lot has been going on.
Oh, yeah.
Since the last time.
No doubt. No doubt. Yes, very much so.
So why don't you talk a little bit about your documentary that you're doing right now in Cleveland?
Yeah, this. So how this began. So this is a running challenge that I'm doing. It began during the pandemic. Because I get tired of running the same, you know, routes all the time. So I'm a neighborhood development city planner type person. And so, of course, I'm interested in all the neighborhoods in Cleveland. And so I decided that I would start to try to run every single street in Cleveland, which is a lot of streets.
Yes, it is.
I think it's like 3,000 miles of street miles. So, I mean, this is a project that's going to take years. But what I decided to do was, while I did this, I created a blog or a website, and I researched the hell out of every neighborhood, and particularly even every section of every neighborhood that I was going to do. And so every run that I do, I list, you know, all the notable landmarks, all the cool historical things about, you know, the things in the neighborhood, some fun facts. And then I take photos of everything, and not just the landmarks, but just random stuff that probably the average person would never know. Like if you're running down this little court or alley or something that, you know, was built in the 1830s or something that, you know, it's the back end to homes. Most people are not going to ever go down those little courts. But when you do go down there, you find amazing public art, you know, like just randomly on the back of like a building or something like that. Just all cool, like things like that, and document it. So I started doing this. And I got, I don't know, 25 or so runs in. And then, you know, people started really paying attention to this. And the local media got a hold of it. And so they reached out to me and they said, hey, this is a really cool story. We think it's going to be a cool story. We'd love to film this. You know, we'd like to do a story about it. So I was thinking, like, you know, I've done so many interviews in Youngstown. I was thinking Yes. This would be like a little, you know, minute story where they, you know, they interview you, you give a sound bite, and then they might get some B-roll of you just like running down the street.
Yes.
No. Yeah. This was like a mini movie production. I've done 5 hours of shooting so far.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now it'll probably end up being like a 5-minute piece or something.
So are they videoing you as you run as well?
They are, but what I told them was like, it's not going to be ideal to try to do this while I'm in an act doing a quote unquote legit, you know, run, because it's like running in neighborhoods like that with a camera crew, the way that they wanted to film is too disruptive to a residential environment. And also, like, I stop so much to take photos and do things. If I was like, if they were just to film me doing like what a normal run looks like, it wouldn't be good for the camera, you know, it just would look weird. So what we did was we like,
it was very intuitive of you.
Yeah. Well, you know, I kind of put myself in their position thinking like, well, this will be super annoying for a camera guy, like if they got to do this. So what we did was we just...
Although it would have been interesting to see them chase after you as you run.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, because I mean, like Cleveland neighborhoods are super, they're super dense and there's a lot of traffic. So the way that they wanted to do this were, you know, like, I mean, like, so they affixed a GoPro on my chest and then they put three cameras on a van. For different angles. And then so they would get me running like on a street 10 times. I had to do 10 takes of something.
Oh, wow.
In different angles.
Does that include in your mileage for the week?
No, it doesn't. I mean, like it does on my Strava, right? It should. My personal little Excel spreadsheet. But yeah, it doesn't, unfortunately, for the overall run. So we just picked a neighborhood, one area in particular that I think is really cool with history, where I could talk a lot about, you know, the history. So, and it was streets that were not too busy. And so we could do all the shooting that they wanted to do. But we did that. And I've done three shoots in 5 hours. And, you know, the last one was on the Lorraine Avenue Bridge, which is like where the baseball stadium's at with the Guardian statues.
Yeah.
They did drone footage of that. So it's really cool.
That is cool.
Yeah. You see me running like along the bridge with the city skyline in the back. And they were showing me this footage, like after they would do a shoot, then they would show it to me. I'm like, wow, this looks incredible. It looked like Rocky or something. Like, you know? So I'm excited. Hopefully this will, you know, look cool when it comes out in the end. And I don't know when it'll air. They're right now, they're editing everything, so it could be any day or any time. But
well, one thing's for sure, you're definitely going to be the person that knows the most about Cleveland at the end over anyone else that has lived there for an extended period of time. I mean, you really will know everything.
Yeah, I think you're right, and that's why I think people are interested, because they're learning about Cleveland too as they follow my journey. We're all like discovering this together. And to my knowledge, from what I could research, I don't know of any other person who's ever attempted this before. So
I've never heard of it.
Right. Yeah. So I can't find anything.
And you know, we're always told by other runners about other books that we should read that we would find interesting, whether it be actually like mechanics of how you run to actually the stories of the runner. So no one has ever brought anything like this to my attention.
Right. Right. Yeah, I haven't discovered it either. There's a guy in
Pittsburgh. Might be a book deal coming.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, we can just summarize like the highlights of this website.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, if anybody's interested, is everystreetcleveland.com. Pretty simple. Everystreetcleveland.com. So you can go there. There's like a little subscribe button if you want to just get emails like whenever I post. I try to do the runs one time a weekend, usually on Sundays, because it takes a long time to do like just one run, because you have to identify that the neighborhood section you're going to run. You then have to study the route because you want to be as efficient as possible. And then, of course, all the history. You know, you're looking mm-hmm. for all the landmarks. It's like Wikipedia in a way. Like you find maybe one building or church or a business that has an interesting story to it, but then it leads to five other interesting things that connect dots about so many other things in other parts of Cleveland. So you just end up spending hours and hours researching maybe just like one thing that expands your knowledge about so many other things in Cleveland. And so by the time you get done with doing even one post, to include then going out and actually doing the run and then yes. taking all the photos and editing all the photos, that takes like, you know, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 hours sometimes just to do one.
And this is where the food also comes into play too, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I try to find kind of the most iconic restaurant in that mm-hmm. particular section. And then, you know, I highlight the other restaurants, but I'll pick like at least one and go get my post-run meal there and then take a photo of that. So yeah, it's been really cool.
That is yeah. really cool. That's a lot of fun. And how long are the runs?
Roughly, I would say on average, no less. They're probably around 5 miles.
Okay. You
know, runs. So there are some that just my runs, I have to carve off kind of based on also just the natural boundary of an area, you know, mm-hmm. so if it makes sense to kind of maybe stop short at 4 miles or 3.5 for something, because it just the way that the neighborhood just like kind of ends there or something. But I would say the longest run I've ever done was probably 8 or 9 miles. And then the shortest was like, you know, maybe like 3, 3.5 miles. So it's about 5, I think, on average.
Are you finding when you're doing the research for these neighborhoods? I mean, because you just mentioned like Ohio City. We know that the Warehouse District in mm-hmm. Cleveland, we know how Cleveland has been exceptional at identifying areas and new areas that help stimulate and growth in the economy, in the community, everything.
Right.
Are you finding like when you're identifying these neighborhoods that we might not know the names of them, but they identify themselves with a particular name?
Yeah, there's usually some kind of history associated with the name. Some of the neighborhoods are named after people, notable people from those neighborhoods, you know, like architects or folks like that, for like initial council people or something like that, some founding, you know, person of like that area. Some neighborhoods are just simply named after the main streets in that neighborhood. So like, for example, Clark Fulton, that's Clark Avenue and Fulton Avenue. That's a neighborhood on the west side, the lower or the south end of West Side. And that's how it gets its name. Same thing with the neighborhood I live in, Detroit Shoreway. Detroit Avenue is a main commercial street. The Shoreway is like the main boulevard near the lake. And so that's how. But yeah, that's also interesting, too, is just doing some of the research on some of these neighborhoods. And again, like when you do that, you then learn about, you know, 10 other things mm-hmm. that, you know, that person was involved with. And oh, it's like, oh, I didn't know that they were also the initial proprietor for this major business in, you know, Cleveland, and or they gave money to start this church, which led to 5 other churches in the city, you know, things like that. So
and you learned more about the people that created the communities that they were in. And it's more than just the 2 names or 3 names that we often hear kicked around when we're in town. Like I know we know the Wick family here.
Right, exactly.
But there's more than just the Wick family here.
Exactly.
There's a lot of various different major players
Butler, obviously, that's another major player. But there's a lot of them that we have, even here, that you might not even think about.
Right.
But at one point, they were a major player that was thought about enough that they had a street named after them, right. Identified, I don't even know what the word is, major monument or whatever in the area that is named after them.
Yes, exactly.
Which is pretty neat.
Right. Yeah, the equivalent of that in cities like Cleveland are like that, like getting neighborhoods named after you or, you know, things like that. Because there are just so many more things and people, you know, in a slightly larger city that, whereas like in Youngstown, you know, we kind of know the handful of names that were like the, you know, the legacy type, you know,
yes.
names. Stanball, Butler, Wick, you know.
Powers,
right. And then if you go back even further, the John Youngs and the Sheehys and, you know.
Yes.
Which a lot of people don't even know because like that's almost the pioneering phase. And like John Young got a monument, you know, dedicated to him. But then like the people that came after him, the next wave of the Butlers and the Wicks, they don't have monuments, but they have buildings and streets and stuff like that. And that's,
yes.
that's kind of like a lot of Cleveland is like that phase when the city was being developed.
Which is awesome. It really
yeah.
is.
Absolutely it is. Yeah. It's an interesting just to understand the amount of influence those people had and how that they were thinking about their legacy in regards to their wealth that they had accumulated and the things that they found important that are actually the assets that you still build off to this day.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty interesting.
It's funny because I had Bill Lawson here as well as on a podcast. And it's like, that's when your mind really starts working. You're like, well, you're constantly, even today, you're looking at things that are going to be historical in value.
Yeah, yes, right.
Like it's constant. So you think about everything that they're collecting
right.
at the Tyler Museum and everything in their archives below that 20 years, 30, 50 years from now, our great, great, great grandkids or whatever are going to come back and look at something that we have right now
right.
that's been a historical identifier, which is pretty extraordinary.
It is. And it's why it's important that organizations like the Historical Society exist.
Because yes.
history is so easy to forget, you know.
Yes.
And particularly as things evolve and, you know, today's day and age, we forget because we're overloaded with so much information. We forget what happened last week.
This is true.
Yes.
I forget what happened yesterday.
Same here. Exactly. Well, I got my second shot yesterday, so I did not forget yesterday.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Mine was on Wednesday. Actually, my fully vaccinated date, I guess, would be Cinco de Mayo.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Yes. That's quite a pairing there.
I have never celebrated Cinco de Mayo before, but I think this year I may go out for a margarita.
Yes.
That'll be fun.
You should do that. You should. We've all earned it and your timeline lines up perfect. You should do that.
Sure. I know. Can't miss that opportunity.
Exactly. Right. That's right.
So you were just recently and which... Full disclosure, Phil already knows that him and I are on two different sides when it comes
to... Western Reserve. Yeah, right. Right.
So, but I do. I am interested because I did read the article and about how you noted in Cleveland
yeah.
How they are concentrating more on a centralized location, and which I do agree with you on. Like, yeah. I am all about making the core as strong as possible. And then from there... the arms, the legs, everything else will be able to be strong as well.
Right, right.
So I do agree with you on that.
Yeah.
However, I still believe that there is a desperate need because it is an artery in Boardman mm-hmm. that is it does create a lot of congestion. I, of course, would love while they do that, they include sidewalks, they include
exactly.
pedestrian, like make yeah. it a complete street,
right,
it, which
right.
is the new... coin term before it was mixed use for residential or commercial development. Now it's complete street.
Yeah, exactly right. That's right. Yeah, and we're talking about the expansion of Western Reserve Road, and so the point of my post and what's happening in Cleveland is organizations like Eastgate here locally. They are the organizations that receive money from the federal government. And then determine how those dollars will be used for transportation related stuff.
Yes.
So those are the road repavings and or expansions and things like that. And recently they had announced that they decided that they were going to attempt to widen Western Reserve Road in order to attract future development to Western Reserve Road. And that in and of itself is the issue. It's not the improvement to Western Reserve. That road's very beat up in sections. It certainly needs repaved. And I think the improvements, the dollars that should go into Western Reserve Road should be for the things you mentioned. There's not, from my recollection of driving that street and also looking at Google Street View, there's just whole large sections that don't even have sidewalks.
So I ran it this morning.
You ran it this morning, right.
So okay. There's
none at all.
I can attest, and I know even into Canfield, all the way down past White House Farms, there's no sidewalks. But wow. From Tippy to all the way through up until, actually, there's just no sidewalks.
Yeah.
As far as you can go on Western Reserve, there's no sidewalks.
Wow.
There is a little bit of a shoulder, which I was appreciative of, but I definitely felt every time a large truck went by.
Sure. It's scary.
I was like blown away.
Absolutely.
But there is definitely the traffic congestion. So I do agree with you when you're talking about the development and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I know that when it comes to like Beaver Township, so Beaver Township, pretty much, they were maybe about a decade ago, they had a comprehensive plan done.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you know what a comp plan is. Like, future use, this is what we see would be best suited for this area.
Yeah.
Beaver Township pretty much took that entire comp plan at that time and rezoned everything.
I'm sure.
Which is quite amazing. But I won't get into whether I agree with that tactic or disagree with it.
Right.
But typically future use is future use. And that usually comes when somebody presents the need and the want, and then you refer back to your manual, if you will,
sure,
and say, well, you know, this falls in line with what our consultant said, but yeah, whatever. Yeah. So, but there is that traffic congestion over there, mm-hmm, because it's become such a main artery that people utilize, because there has been growth out in Columbiana.
Mm-hmm.
There is development that's happening on Western Reserve towards Poland a lot,
mm-hmm,
that it does become a little bit of a, and there have been accidents over there. So it becomes a higher risk area, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I look at it as a need base, not the future, which is, I'm a real estate agent, but I'm not looking at it as necessarily development. Yes, I do think that if you're going to do it, like, keep in mind future-wise what could be that could be utilized for. Don't just dump a whole bunch of money into it without thinking that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to see it. I would like to see it, like, complete streets if they're going to do it.
Well, I agree on that. That much we can agree on. I certainly think that it warrants, you know, just basic infrastructure and
yeah,
those things, like with sidewalks. And I would even suggest, you know, the inclusion of bike lanes or even using some of the right-of-way,
yes,
widening the sidewalks.
I would love that.
Right. And in Cleveland, we're doing that in some areas on corridors where we're using the large right-of-way, the tree lawn areas that are sizable. And we're expanding the sidewalks to twice the normal length and using half of that as a multi-use path, you know, so that you would have, you wouldn't even be on the street. You wouldn't have to compete with any vehicular traffic in a dedicated bike lane. You would simply be in the off the street on a right-of-way, utilizing that large right-of-way on a sidewalk. So I think there's opportunity there.
Is that something similar to what they're doing on Mahoning Avenue right now, trying to connect to the park?
It is, but that is also still kind of on the street itself. But what's nice and good about that project is they've actually made it protected. So they've created that raised barricade of sorts,
yes,
you know? And that's great, because that's actually a best practice design if you're going to do a dedicated bike path on a street. But I think with Western Reserve, there's so much space on the sides of those streets that instead of expanding the road to two lanes, what I think what you're going to do, there's multiple reasons for why they should not do this, but one of those things you take away is the ability than to do something like this. You know, you're using that for another vehicle lane, which is only going to increase speed and traffic flow and, quite honestly, more traffic accidents and things like that over time. And so while I understand that there might be a need, which is a whole other conversation, because the reason that there's a need now is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, which is in the sense that you have to have an understanding of like the evolution, how we got to this point, which is the short version of that is that, you know, a place like Youngstown, which was the population center, you know, initially.
Yes.
And the peak population in Youngstown was around 150,000. And that was in around 1930.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people think that when the steel mills closed, that's when we started losing population.
No, we started losing it beforehand.
Exactly. We started losing it decades beforehand. And it was because of out-migration from the city for suburban sprawl. The reason for that was because, you know, people, when they first moved here as immigrants or whomever, we didn't have people didn't own cars. It was all public transportation. So you either had to walk to work or you had to take a streetcar. And so the housing was all concentrated around the steel mills and along the valley. And then as more people came and industry grew and the streetcar lines built out further, more neighborhoods developed. And then around after World War II, you had the baby boom scenario and people were coming back. The automobile was more prevalent. More people could own that. So people were buying automobiles, which meant that they could live further out. And so then in the 50s and the 60s, the federal government initiated the Highway Act. And so then they overlaid the cities and cut a lot of those neighborhoods up and also subsidized the development of the suburbs. So they were actually subsidizing. It was more affordable to build a new home in the suburbs than it was to try to retrofit or live closer in the city itself. So all this was publicly subsidized, whether it was the highway systems themselves or the incentives through taxes to build new out here. And so we saw this great out-migration. And so that's understandable at that point in time, like yes. That level of out-migration. Because we were also still growing as a region. The city of Youngstown was losing population, but Mahoning County was still like growing. It was just the suburbs were growing, right? And that's true of many other areas. But then what ends up happening, as we know, is that we begin to lose the economy. The steel mills close in the 1970s, and we start to lose population. And that's true of Youngstown, of Cleveland, many other cities like that. And so what continued to happen was further growth and expansion outward. So we're losing people, but we're building more homes and we're building more infrastructure that's publicly subsidized. And as we know, 40, 50, 60 years later, all we have to do is look around and see the effects of that. We have way more infrastructure, way more housing than we have people and families. And it's a major burden to not only a taxpayer, but all the associated things that come with that, all the fallout, whether it's the neighborhoods, the conditions they are in places like Youngstown, even now affecting North Boardman. But we continue to build further out. So while we fast forward to today and now we have a quote unquote need, you know, for Western Reserve to be widened. And the reason for that is because of this kind of unchecked, probably arguably poorly planned incentive to keep building further and further out in a region that is not experiencing growth. We are building in a time where we're losing population. Whereas other communities like Washington, D.C. or other growth areas, they would be justified, of course, you know, to have to build out Western Reserve because the growth is actually happening.
Well, part of the reason why D.C. and their real estate market is at the expense that it is now is because geographically, it's a small city.
Yeah.
In all contexts, it's a small city. And then you also have the limitations on how high buildings can be.
Right.
So with that, when you're talking about the growth and when it comes to the population and then the ability to keep continually developing.
Right.
With all those restraints, that's what's helped their real estate market to increase. Now, of course, I'm sure that there's conversations there that are, especially right now, that they're getting concerned that they're going to have the same problem that California is having right now when it comes to their housing market because they don't want to be at that level.
Right, sure.
Though either. Everybody wants to be at that sweet spot.
Right.
But they've been dealing with housing prices escalating to an insane amount.
Yeah.
And plus DC also has this, it's called TOPA. And it is Tenant Opportunity Protection Affidavit. I probably screwed that acronym completely up. I just know that you will have attorneys drive around DC that have on their car got TOPA.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. It's basically legalized extortion. And yeah. and it's like, so you have like Capitol Hill staffers that might be renting a townhouse in DC. So that owner decides to sell their townhouse. That tenant basically has ownership rights.
Wow.
So it is, it's beyond a right of first refusal. Yeah. Now, the whole concept of that was to protect people because of gentrification, the negative term that's out there.
Yeah.
Of course, we utilize transitional, yeah. but basically was to protect those occupants of properties of a major developer coming in, buying the property, and kicking them out.
Oh, yeah.
So it was a way that, yes, the developers did have to pay the tenants money to have them relocate someplace else. They couldn't just say, get out, that's it, we're just not renewing your lease agreement or whatever it may be.
Sure.
But it then got to a point that it was just that Hill staffer that was like, hey, let's see what I can get out of this owner, even though I can just go someplace else and pay rent. So I know that DC was working on those laws to help restrict that from happening, because it did get to a point that was insane.
Yeah.
But so their market's a little bit different over there when it comes to the population. It's interesting when you're talking about the population here and how even when you're talking about the push out, the suburban sprawl.
Yeah.
How we're still made, it's still the same population.
Right.
But yeah, we keep building.
Since the 1970s, I think the stat is since the 70s, the overall population in Northeast Ohio, so like Cleveland, Akron, Canton, Youngstown, Warren, has lost somewhere between 7-8% overall. But we extended our physical build outs 25%. So our populations in all these regions are continuing to decline, and we're continuing to build more, and we're spreading out further.
And that's happening over in other regions as well.
For sure. Yeah. Now, in Cleveland's case, the reason why I brought this up on Defend Youngstown was that the Eastgate of Cleveland has finally made the choice to say, this has to end. This is a net negative as far as growth and stability as a region if we continue to do this. So how they're evaluating decisions like Western Reserve Road now is not whether it will impact or benefit that Boardman or, you know, that corridor. They now use a metric, an evaluation strategy that determines what will be the net effect on this to the region. Let's just use this example here locally. Would widening Western Reserve Road and encouraging future development have a net negative impact in 20 or 30 years on North Boardman, Youngstown, the core community? You know, are we building more infrastructure and spreading more people out, which we know will make the region, it will create more challenges because of the additional maintenance and all the other associated issues that come with this over time if we continue to lose population and tax base? That's how they're looking at it in Cleveland. And so they've made this decision, and it's a big deal, you know, because they have to, the board of that organization is very similar to the one how it's structured here, where it's not just Cleveland. Cleveland has a vote, but it's all the suburban leadership. It's, you know, the county leadership. They're collectively determining that this is something that's necessary for stability as a region moving forward.
So basically the concern is suburban decay, if you will. If you keep creating something new, what happens to what's there?
Exactly. What will 224 look like in 20 years from now if Western Reserve becomes the new 224? What will that look like? And so that's the concern. I think if you were to compare projects that Eastgate has done recently, kind of for a value proposition thing, I would hold up the projects like the Glenwood Avenue Corridor project, where they're trying to work with Boardman Township and the city of Youngstown to develop a comprehensive strategy for Glenwood Avenue from 224 to Mahoning Avenue and try to solidify that district, or the Belmont Avenue project from Liberty into the city.
They need to work on Market Street.
Well, sure. That would be arguably the most important.
Yes.
But I think the way to think about these projects too is you kind of want to, in some ways, build from strength. You know, you want to look at corridors that are kind of like right teetering and Belmont and Glenwood are good candidates because they're still fairly stable and there's still a market that could be developed around them. Whereas Market Street it would be a little bit more challenging, but it's a more prominent corridor. But anyway, point being, like, Market Street would also be another good example, you know. Whereas if you're putting dollars into widening Western Reserve, what is going to be the net effect of that to the rest of the existing community in another generation?
But what's interesting about that, so then you have Market Street. How many lanes is that? That's 4 lanes, isn't it?
Yeah, it, definitely in certain areas.
So yeah. There you would think that Market Street, because Market Street does not get a lot of traffic.
Right.
I would say Glenwood has more traffic than Market Street.
Sure.
But of course, it's 4 lanes first too. So maybe that's my visualization of how many cars I'm behind. But I would think Market Street doesn't need to be 4 lanes.
I would agree with you.
So, and that would be a great opportunity, like you were saying, with the complete street, with the bike lanes totally. And the sidewalks and pedestrian and everything, totally. Which I'm a major advocate of everywhere. And I do wish, this is one of those hindsights, but I do wish our planners back in the day had that hindsight to make sure that even though you're in suburbia, you still have sidewalks. You still, when developers are asking for approval for their PUDs or whatever it is that they're creating, plaza strips, whatever, that they took the opportunity to then require to make sure that
to do it.
Yes, the pedestrian.
I think you're absolutely right. When those corridors were built, there were two things that they were faced with back in like the 50s. One was that some of these corridors were streetcar lines, so they just basically removed the center like streetcar lane and kept the same width of the road, and so then they just filled it in with 2 lanes on each side, you know.
Yep.
But it was also at a time where everybody was car crazy, you know, like everybody thought, and it's true to this day.
We're very car-centric.
Car-centric, exactly, yeah. Right. And also, this region is a place that produces cars in Detroit. And,
yes. You know,
so, like, we wanted to encourage people to purchase cars because it supported the local economy or the regional
which
economy.
Which, ironically, was never the car that was produced, at least in the last decade.
Yeah, exactly right. That's right. But now we know that, like, we don't need – our roads are way too wide. They don't justify the width of these streets. And what would be a better use of that space now is a more of a complete street design where you make sure that you have – ample adequate sidewalks and preferably, you know, at least the option for a bike lane where it exists, but certainly reducing the lanes from 4 to 2, not only just because you don't need it, but it's also just a safety issue. I mean, like these become mini highways and it's just not where we need to be. And so I totally agree with you. And that's exactly the kind of corridor projects that I would love to see those dollars from Eastgate go towards. Is like, could you imagine those dollars that we're spending on Western Reserve over the next 3 years going.
I still think they should be spent there.
Well, I do. I agree with you for the sidewalks and the bike lanes, but not widening.
I do think it. I think it should all be done at once. And I agree with you that what the reasoning behind it, I might not agree with, but just focused on need base, like no matter what, we're there right now.
And it's true, but when is it going to end? You know, like that's what we
say. Never ends, but, Bill.
That's why we're at where we're at.
I know.
That's why we continue to lose population. That's why we continue to suffer.
This is the greatest challenge I think you and I and so many other advocates face, and what it's changing people's mentality.
Yeah.
Changing people what they're so used to, like the whole vehicle centric, and changing that mindset of being more pedestrian, having those neighborhood nooks that you do see in Cleveland often. I want to see that everywhere here, whether you're in suburbia or whether you're in the city. Like, I would love to see those connectors.
Yeah.
Like, I love the fact that YNDC has that colorful plaza off of Glenwood, because I think that is like the whole concept of like, yes, you're working on the residential portion of everything, but that little plaza strip is so important to the revitalization of the residential part as well, because it's a strong connectivity.
Right.
And people, I do think the younger generations are veering back to what the older generations always loved and wanted, and that it is that neighborhood community where you do have commercial that meets residential in such a beautiful way.
Right.
So I think it's important. I do think though that, again, you are right. I wish we had a growing population here.
Right.
I wish we had an immense amount of growth. I know we do have new job creation that's happening. I do think that we are currently able, in our footprint that we do have, sustain those new jobs coming into the market,
mm-hmm.
Which is good. Otherwise, they probably wouldn't relocate here. But but I do think at the end of the day, that section over there does need to be addressed. And I'm like, at least from just putting landmarks over by the church off of Hitchcock,
mm-hmm.
up until you get to like, well, the Bread Chef, that's where it starts widening over there.
Right. They did expand that just because the interchange is there.
That yeah. congestion that happens over there because they've already had commercial development.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have Farmers Bank, I believe it's Farmers. I believe so. It's Farmers. Then you have Pure or Omega Bar over there. You have Sparkle, Risers, all these locations over there that I do think that portion, because of everything that happens over in that location, does need to be widened and include the pedestrian portion as well.
Yes.
But I do agree that we should be making more of a conscientious effort to regionally work together
mm-hmm.
when it comes to planning. But there's such, and you know this, there's such a pool of people and tax base. Because, yeah. like, that's the huge problem, oh, right?
Of course, yeah.
We don't have a growing tax base.
Right.
So it's like, let's fight over the tax base that we have.
Yeah. And that's why we have to be all that much more thoughtful and take a much longer view, because we have to mitigate that issue
yes.
over time. And I think you and I agree on the same end. It's a means issue. And
yes. This one's really good. Which one's this one?
Is that the third one?
This one's the third one.
I think that's the Polka City Pilsner.
Yeah. That's cool.
Isn't that good? Yeah. I think it's excellent. Yeah, it's a really good beer. But, you know, I really believe that this area and areas like this are only going to be as strong as the amount of stability we can create back in the core. And the sooner we can get to that point, the better off the whole valley, the whole area is going to be.
I agree.
And by doing that, to reach that end, we cannot keep perpetuating a problem by spreading things out and making areas continuously less competitive and pushing more people in development further and further to other areas, because it's self-evident. We can look at the last 70 years and we can look at that pattern. We can see what the result is.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going to continue. It's kind of just self-interest. If you're living in Western Reserve, I'm sure that you feel that that's justified. But like taking a 30,000 foot view, like what that's doing, for example, all the work that YNDC is doing, like a decision like that is something that actually undermines that work, because as much work you're doing on stability of residential and commercial, you're just setting things up for 20 and 30 years from now, where all that work is going to have to just keep it like a whole nother degree of that. And it's going to include Boardman, and it's going to include Struthers and Campbell and parts of large swaths of Austintown too,
yes.
because they're going to feel the effects of all this push and migration outwards. So I think that it's not a difficult conversation to have, and it's not politically popular in the suburbs because they don't see it as a problem, because things are great. They've benefited from this from the last 70 years. They are doing great, and it's because publicly subsidized decisions like this have happened, and it's great. But the core has suffered for so long that it's not like a kind of F the suburbs thing. It's like, look, but we're all in this together. This whole region is going to be competitive and stabilize and position itself for growth again if we can understand that we've got to solidify what we already have first before we consider continuing to build further out. That's kind of the philosophical or fundamental kind of position I'm coming from on this.
So the real resolution to this is we need more jobs here. More sure. basic jobs.
I think always, no matter this decision or otherwise, yeah, absolutely.
But to bring more people into the area.
Sure.
To then help rectify the situation of, there'll be plenty of tax base.
Sure.
But really, in all honesty, every city government township should be weighted more on the commercial tax base than the residential tax base, and not burden so much the residents to begin with.
I agree. Yeah, sure. I would agree with that for sure.
But yeah.
Yeah.
That was a fun discussion, wasn't it?
It was. You know, quite honestly, I'm glad that you're having it, because like, I think that this is the, this should be a very, this should be a conversation that should be happening with this community valley-wide. And it shouldn't just be, you know, like when I did that post on Defend Youngstown, Jerry Ricciuti called me at KBN. They wanted to do a story. And I said, sure, I'll, you know, I'll give you my perspective. It ended up being like a 30-second piece on the news.
Yes.
Now, this is something that's going to affect the Valley generationally. And I think that the more conversation we can have about this, whether what side you're on, the more education we can have about it, not only about just this decision, but I think it's a gateway to getting people to understand the larger history of development trends in this area.
Yes.
And areas like this, and how we can just be a little more thoughtful overall about things in general, because people of our generation in particular, that might not be that knowledgeable about the history of these such things, they look at a place like Youngstown that's, you know, obviously very challenged and says like, oh, well, that's, you know, they're just, you know, that's just so challenged. And but they don't understand how it got to that point. You know, it's not like Youngstown just like imploded because like, you know, something like a catastrophe happened or something,
yes,
or the steel mills closed. That's not why Youngstown ended up the way it did.
100%.
Right.
Like, I think a lot of blame of the city of Youngstown is just solely, well, the steel mills closed. That's why the city of Youngstown fell.
And that's not the case.
No, it was suburban sprawl.
It was
suburban, or urban sprawl.
Right. Which a lot of the folks that come from families, like, again, in our age, grew up in those suburbs. I was one of them back where I grew up. And I think when you begin to educate people about that, it's not to say that they wouldn't like choose to live in the city of Youngstown, but at least they'll be empathetic and they'll have a better understanding of why and how we got to this point. And I think that when you're presenting options to people about like decisions like this one, they might be a little bit more inclined to be supportive of decisions that are about trying to create more stability, again, within the infrastructure that we've already have.
Well, there'll be definitely, like, again, while we may sit on two different sides when it comes to Western Reserve, number one, while we may disagree on points, we definitely agree on points.
Right.
And I definitely think that having that forethought going forward when it comes to other things that we do in our area is extremely important. And that's I agree with the conversation and make sure we have it, because there are valid points.
Yeah.
So knowing that when we're talking about the creation or like Beaver Township of what they want to do with their area, and this, and again, that's when it comes to the whole competing. Everybody's competing against each other to bring in commercial, bring in residential. That does make it difficult. It really does.
It does. It complicates it big time.
I mean, everybody is trying to...
I know. It's a survival kind of scenario,
yes,
you know, in every community. It also speaks to a much larger problem, which was the fact how balkanized this, you know, regions like this are. We have, I think it's like, I forget exactly, but, you know, we have like 7 municipalities. We have, you know, 14 townships. We have, you know, another half a dozen villages and a bunch of unincorporated.
Yes.
All in one county.
Yes.
And that's like...
And you may agree with me on this, since you were heading down that path, like when we were in Northern Virginia,
mm-hmm,
it's one county
right,
and it is one county board of supervisors, and those board of supervisors represent their nooks.
Yeah.
But everybody has equal voice at the table.
Sure.
Same thing with the school board.
Yeah, sure.
It's one school board for the county.
Absolutely.
And everybody has an equal say at the table. So I am a huge advocate of that.
Yes.
And I do think that that does help when it comes to planning, zoning, all working together,
exactly,
like everything all working together. I do think that helps the issue of thinking and shrinks the competitiveness.
Right.
Because you do. Everybody's got to get on board,
right,
when it comes to whatever development's happening in your county.
Yes.
Or when it comes to school budgets.
Right.
Everybody has to get on board with the school budgets.
Totally agree.
So it's an interesting dynamic. I'm sure there are tons of people who disagree with me on this. But
I think there are, but I also think there's a lot of advocates, because about when I first moved back to Youngstown, the regional chamber was promoting two different initiatives, which had bipartisan support locally. One was the as you mentioned with the school districts, creating one countywide school system in which individual districts could still maintain their autonomy. So Boardman would still be Boardman.
Yes.
But the administration, the management of the school system would be countywide.
Yes.
And so the cost savings of that, and also just like the things that you mentioned, which is just having the precedent of something like that, where the people from different communities all like kind of making a collective county decision about something, that's helpful. And then separately, we were also considering what Allegheny County, where Pittsburgh's at, in Cleveland and in Cuyahoga County, both of these have already gone in this direction, actually Akron as well, is that creating a, instead of a three commission member county government, like three commissioners, to go to a county council, which would be representatives, basically carving up Mahoning County into districts like council wards.
Yes.
And having representatives from each ward, like make a council, and then you would elect a county executive. So that person would be like the CEO of the county, but the county council would have to make a collective decision about things countywide. And so both of those things were initiatives around 06 or 07 that just we got the legislation together, but we just there for whatever reason, they never put it on a ballot. I think it was like, could we raise the money to do a campaign around this? And so they kind of
backed up. That would be probably a lot of money.
It would be a lot of money, yeah, because it's a lot of education.
It's and a pushing. Lot of grassroots.
It's a lot of, yes, exactly right. But I think those are things that I think should be considered in the future, because it would help alleviate some of this division. I agree with you. And those are two concrete examples of things we could do, you know,
yes.
that every other major metropolitan area around us has already done.
Yes.
Except for the school thing, but certainly for the county government thing, they've done that.
Yes, I it would be great. And again, I would like to see both of them, both the school and the county, work in that function. But all right, ready? I know you've done the rapid fire round before.
Oh, the rapid fire. Absolutely. Ready? Yes, okay. Let me get a sip here.
So this one's the coffee stout, right?
This is coffee stout. This is Masthead from downtown Cleveland.
I just want to give myself props because I have tried every one of your beers.
You have.
And I am still able to complete a sentence. So I'm pretty sure these are probably not following my 5% rule.
Oh, I didn't know there was that rule. Sorry.
No, that's two beers. No, that's okay. Very few beers fall in the 5% rule. So there we go. Now I'm starting not to complete my sentences. But all right. Ready?
Ready.
Okay. What's your favorite beer?
My favorite beer would be, I'm actually going to go with the Polk City Pilsner from Goldhorn.
John, that was really good.
It's good. It's good flavor. I like the people that run that brewery. I like the fact that where it's located, East 55th, it's like really the only brewery on the east side in that area. And it's Slovenian. I'm Slovenian. So
there you go.
There you go. So for all those reasons.
So you're biased.
I am biased. Ethnically biased in that sense. Yes.
Right. Okay. So what's your favorite restaurant?
Oh, boy. That's really hard.
Especially because you've been doing all your runs.
I know. I mean, that's really hard. Especially between Cleveland and Youngstown. I mean, where do you...
All right. You can do one in Cleveland, one in Youngstown.
Okay. That's fair. I will do... let's see. You know, There's few things I love more than, you know, some hot raspberry barbecue wings and, you know, a local beer at Royal Oaks, you know.
Yeah,
to me, that's like a go-to. If I brought someone to Youngstown, that's probably the first meal I'm taking them to go get. And if the Golden Dawn opens back up, I'd probably go get them a schooner beer.
Which I think it will.
Yes, I think it will too. I mean, they've been doing a lot of work.
Yes.
So I'd get them a pizza at Golden Dawn and a schooner at Genesee. Those are personally my two like favorite meals. Plenty of other great places in Youngstown, but I'm a foodie in the sense that I really like the kind of the cultural aspect fused with the food. So like you could go to Cleveland, Youngstown, Pittsburgh and find like the best Korean food, you know, and think, but like what's the local like cultural kind of thing, you know?
Yes.
And I think that the Oaks wraps the quality with the culture, you know? So I got to go with the Oaks in Youngstown, and in Cleveland, oh man, that's really hard. There's actually, this is kind of probably an answer that most people would not give, but there's this little diner that is across from Platform Brewery, actually on Lorraine Avenue. It's called Nick's Diner. And there's not any food there that's like notable, like not like Cleveland specific, like Cleveland's known for this food item called the Polish Boy, which is like this sausage sandwich, and it's like the Permane Brothers sandwich of Pittsburgh, but like in Cleveland, and it's, you know, they got a Polish sausage and fries and barbecue sauce, and it's crazy.
Oh, that sounds good.
It's really good, and so like that would be an easy thing to point to and say like I like Polish Boys from Cleveland, because a lot of the restaurants do their own Polish Boys. They're all really awesome. But I like this diner on Lorraine Avenue called Nick's, and they just, like, I go there for breakfast, and they have just amazingly great breakfast, just diner style, that in massive portions. I like the again, like, fusing the culture. They have a very kind of bohemian, Cleveland bohemian feel to it. It has a comic book element, and they have a cool patio. It's minority owned. It's just a really cool place, and so, like, I like going there myself, and I like taking people there too, and particularly after runs.
I like seeing places that you feel like you know the owners a lot more.
Right.
Like exactly. That you can feel that it's not like repose gray on the walls and like very basic. Like you feel like you have a bit of the owner in that space and who they are. So that's pretty cool.
For sure.
Yeah. All right, ready?
Yes, ready.
Favorite local gem.
Local gem. I'll do Cleveland Youngstown again.
Okay.
You know, I have a very soft spot in my heart for Wick Park on the north side of Youngstown. You know, I spent a considerable amount of time and effort trying to improve the park. It's still got a long ways to go, but over the course of 10 years of...
There's a lot you could do in Wick Park right now.
There is,
there's
sure.
There's a lot of recreational activity.
There is. There's a lot. And there's more that we could do. And in fact, before I left, I had successfully written a grant for $73,000 for the improvement of the interior running trail, the walking trail inside.
Oh, wow.
But we want to do, that was only half the funding. We really want to do like a really top level trail there that would have the type of surface material that is cushioned and just really like excellent.
The rubber mulch.
Rubber mulch. Exactly. Kind of like a track, you know, yep. But like for more like an outdoor park.
Yes.
And with proper signage and markings and all that stuff. So it was like a $140,000 project. I had raised about half before I left. And there's other things we could do there. But I really like that park. And because I think it's so unique. Like there's very hard, it's very hard to find something similar to that in other cities where you have a 34-acre, like beautiful park in the middle of a historic district like that. The foresight of the city of Youngstown back in 1889 to carve that out was something, because that could have been prime residential area, especially that neighborhood.
Yes.
That was where the industrial elite lived. So to have that, and that actually predated, that park predates Mill Creek Park. They created that park first because they wanted some kind of oasis, you know?
Oh, wow.
And then Mill Creek Park kind of came like very shortly after that. But as we know the history of Mill Creek Park, you know, that was quite an effort by Volney Rogers to win that battle, you know. So Wick Park, I just love it. It's my soft spot. In Cleveland, that's tough. You know, I don't think it's like a specific thing. It's an area. There's this cool peninsula in the flats, which technically is called the Columbus Peninsula. It's where I did my filming for the running challenge thing with the news. And what's cool about it is it looks like a tonsil, like along the Cuyahoga River.
Yes.
But it's technically the flats. And what's cool about it was that in the 1830s, this little peninsula was called Cleveland Center. They thought that this was going to be the epicenter of where all residential, just basically the center point of life and everything, the origin of Cleveland was going to come from this peninsula, because at that time, this is before the railroad system. So you had to use the waterways to navigate commerce or travel. And they had built the canal. They were working on the canal system from Cleveland to Akron to do more commerce. And so they positioned this little peninsula in downtown Cleveland as like, hey, this is Cleveland Center. And what's really cool about it is that when they laid it out as like an arterial, like if you were to cut a wheel in half, you know, it's spokes.
Yeah.
So they wanted to promote the diversity of Cleveland, and so they named the intersecting streets Britain, China, French, you know, different countries. But then they also aligned the grid pattern so that the solstice and the equinoxes would align perfectly on a certain street during those certain times of year. And they named the other intersecting streets after the seasons, spring, fall, winter, summer. And they use this mathematic formula to kind of come up with this, like, almost kind of druid-like.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. And they called the town.
You ever think that maybe they thought a lot more about things than we do
I
now?
I think that they did, probably, because they just sat around thinking, like, what could be the most, you know, interesting. But they did this, and they called basically the public square Gravity Place. And this got lost in history. Because after, in the 1840s, there's a recession. All that property got sold off on sheriff's sale because everybody lost their ass because of the recession.
Oh, yeah.
And then the railroad lines came in and they just put railroads through there. But what's cool is that to this day, half of those streets still exist in some form or fashion. And so this artist came along 2 years ago, dove deep into the history of all this and did all these cool murals that talk about the history of this and the grade patterns. And a lot of those buildings from the 1830s and 1850s still exist there. But it's like this kind of mostly like older industrial place, but I just love it just for the history and all that cool, like, you know, the fusing of the equinox with it and just like its history of going back to 1830. And I just think it's the coolest place. So that's my soft spot. I like that place.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. Yeah. I wish we would see a lot more murals and artistry around Youngstown.
For sure. Yeah. There's a lot of opportunity.
Yes, there is. I know YSUscape has been doing a really good job with that. So we just need more. So please keep it up. And thank you. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Cheers. All
right. Cheers.